Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines and the stories that make our community tick. Abortion's in the headlines now. We have a back scene story about abortion in our community at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries that have maybe some points to make today about what we're talking about abortion. Our guest today is Marcia Biederman, an author of the new book, The Disquieting Death of Emma Gill. Abortion, Death, and Concealment in Victorian New England. It's from Chicago Review Press. Marcia has an event coming up next week at the New Haven Public Library. A lot to talk about. And Marcia's also an old friend, and she's began her journalism career in the 1980s in New Haven and has taken it quite far since then. Marcia, thanks so much for coming to town to be on Dateline New Haven.
Thank you for having me, Paul. It's great to be here.
Well, I loved reading your book, but that wasn't a surprise. I kind of knew it would before I read it. But let's tell people, just because it's not just the storyline, but the storyline is great. It's about the 1898 horrific death and trial of involving a woman who got an illegal abortion that opened window into the practice of abortion in New Haven in Bridgeport. My favorite part is about quacks and abortionists on the run, one step ahead of the law, chopping up and burying bodies. What is the story? What's the short summary?
Well, it begins in 1898 when a group of schoolboys in Bridgeport are playing on a bridge, and they notice on the mudflats below some white packages, and they go down and open them up, and a head rolls out of one and a leg out of the other, and pretty soon the police are called, and the whole town converges on the scene. And what has happened is that these are the remains of a young woman, and the police are unable to identify her, but the medical examiner quickly determines that she had recently had an abortion, because despite the dismemberment of the body and the gutting of the corpse, the person who tried to conceal what happened didn't do a very good job, and the medical examiner sees that the young woman died from the consequences of an infection that set in after an abortion. This 1898 abortion is illegal in every state in the nation. There has been a doctor's campaign against abortion. There have been special federal agents railing against abortion. It's a chilling atmosphere in which for an abortion provider to work. They are criminals subject to harsh prison sentences. And yet, everybody knows then in New Haven and in Bridgeport, if you want an abortion, you can go to Dr. Nancy Guilford, who has offices in both cities. She's recently closed down her New Haven offices because the law enforcement is really cracking down in New Haven, but she's applying her trade in Bridgeport. And the rest of the book is link by link. The police in Bridgeport, and not very skillfully, putting together evidence which will eventually bring Nancy Guilford, the abortion provider, to trial.
And well, actually, you know, that's the frame of the book. You go so much deeper. So you show us how the police and the press, really, because I didn't realize how much reporters were detectives in those days. They weren't just transcribers. Piece together whose body it was, where they got an abortion. You got the backstory. We find out, you know, Emma Gill's name is in the title. I would argue she's not a main character in the book. We find out all about her, find out about all a bunch of other young women who got abortions. But what we really get deeper is the whole environment in which they got abortions. And I would argue that the two main characters are Nancy Guilford and her husband, who also performed abortions, Henry Guilford, who was kind of a con artist. And that's what I found so fascinating. Like, you showed us how the police and reporters unraveled the story, and you unraveled a deeper story about how abortion took place. Was that your goal?
Yes, I did center on the abortion providers to show how they were practicing almost openly, despite the...
Right, their ads in the paper had the wink words that you didn't have to be the sharpest detective in the world to know what was going on there, and they kind of allowed it, right?
Yeah.
Did they have to get paid off, or someone they knew got the abortions, or powerful people? How'd that work?
Well, I never found evidence that they were paying off the police. I think that they may have. They were extremely wealthy. But they practiced for three decades, starting in Massachusetts and then when Henry was thrown out of Massachusetts and Nancy was sent to jail for over 5 years, they resumed their trade in Waterbury and Meriden.
And they would get run out of a town and they'd set up somewhere else. They kept, like Henry kept changing his name.
Yes.
And he was a complete huckster. Like he called himself a doctor. He wasn't a doctor. But it was also interesting to me how in those days, it seemed like a turning point in the book where there weren't credentials really to be a doctor. Then their grads were starting to be credentials and he was being left out and he didn't like that because he was sort of like a medicine doctor, but fake, like, you know, sort of a carnival guy.
I think he would have been happy to stay in quackery, but because he needed a woman, most male abortion providers did need a woman to assist them. And in his case, it was his wife, Nancy. In other cases, there was a woman in New Haven named Gertrude Vaughn who provided she had like a post-abortion clinic where she cared for women in what was called a boarding house.
Well, the Guilfords also have these facilities in New Haven and Bridgeport and Waterbury where you went for a few days if you were getting the abortion,
yes,
right?
Yes.
It was sort of a boarding house. Yeah,
exactly. But rather than paying another person, Henry had Nancy to do it. Otherwise, yeah, he would have stayed with his selling snake oil and using.
And it really was snake oil. I like that. Like, you know, we always hear that as like a metaphor. It wasn't a metaphor. They sold snake oil.
He tried anything. Yeah. There were a lot of different fads, electricity,
but, you know,
to cure everything,
we
polio.
We laugh about it because I think you and I both love hucksters and writing, you know, scammers. But as you write so movingly at times in the book, is that this was serious business. Okay, snake oil salesmen, people who were pretending to do stuff they couldn't do. But they were performing life or death, in some cases death, operations on women who had no place to go.
Yes.
When they needed an abortion because it was illegal but allowed with a wink. That's what moved me the most in your book, is what it meant for these women who were in desperate situations.
And it was filling a need. That's why they could thrive despite the criminality. It was like prohibition. It just doesn't work. It was a social reality and at the turn of the last century that women of all classes were getting abortions. Everybody could see it around them. There's this wonderful book called Abortion in America by a historian named James C. Moore that was published in the late 1970s that describes it as a social reality. Everyone could see the evidence of abortion anytime they looked around. The size of the American family was plunging. And why? Contraception, reliable contraception wasn't available. So the estimates were that one out of more than three, or wait, at least one out of 10 pregnancies was terminated.
Wow.
And this is
and it was all done illegally. It was all done by people not licensed. Many of them were quacks like these guys.
Well, I would say they became experienced clinicians.
She did. I didn't get the sense of him. Was he experienced there?
I think he mainly had her do the work.
Yeah.
Most of the deaths that did occur should be put in perspective. They were practicing for more than 20 years. And it says, my book focuses on the women who died as a consequence of abortion because that's when the press and the police came swinging out to crack down on something that they knew had been going on. As long as nobody had died, or if they had died,
they try to cover it. They get it quietly buried until it was unable to.
In many cases, the families probably cooperated.
Well, you talked about that in a book. One another cases where the family didn't want any trouble, and the practitioners knew that. They knew when they had a death. What got interesting to me was how cold-hearted and practical they were. When they had someone die, they were mad, and they would deal with. They had leverage over the families not to let it be known, because then the families would be in trouble because they were complicit.
Well, and
I'm talking about the body brought back to Massachusetts in the middle of the night in the back of that
truck.
Right.
Well, yes. The farmer just wanted to sweep that. Who was the father of the unfortunate woman? Just wanted to sweep that under the rug. He had a new wife who had brought children, you know, adult children into the family. So he had this.
I.e. witnesses. That's what I loved. Yes. The adult children didn't have the tie to the father were watching what was going on. And we're talking to Marcia Biederman, who has a fascinating new book out, The Disquieting Death of Emma Gill, Abortion, Death, and Concealment in Victorian New England. And that Victorian New England is New Haven and Bridgeport. Marcia, how'd you get onto this story?
Uh, I was researching something totally different, and newspapers.com, which is this great subscriber-only
Carol
archive.
Wife uses that for genealogical research, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a real boon to researchers, and this was during the pandemic, one thing led to another, and I was looking at San Francisco. I forget what I was really researching, but I saw in a San Francisco newspaper, Bridgeport murder mystery, and I wasn't sure it was my Bridgeport where I was born and brought up, Bridgeport, Connecticut, but it was. So I was immediately intrigued, and I went on a Facebook group called Bridgeport Born and Bred and asked other people, have you heard of this? And they hadn't, but it was a huge deal in Bridgeport. Like every year, Bridgeport had published like a blue book about the events of the previous year, and Nancy Guilford was all over the blue book. It had brought reporters from New York who were camping out here or taking the trains back and forth.
I mean, one reporter, what I loved, pretended to be a state investigator and went in prison and did one interview with one of the people. Another reporter met the boat in, was it England, where Nancy Guilford was fleeing, so she wouldn't be arrested. And as she's coming off the boat, there's a reporter, not the cops, the reporter who's there getting on the boat, having someone tell where she is and charting her whereabouts in real time for international readers.
And in the end, the reporter also linked Nancy Guilford because she had been under suspicion because everybody knew of her in Bridgeport, but they couldn't link her to Emma Gill. And after Emma Gill was finally identified, and her head was put on display in the city morgue in Bridgeport, because
she was first misidentified, right?
She was first misidentified.
And this head picture was on newspapers around the country.
Yes.
Her head was on display. They're trying to figure out who this woman was that dished out of the harbor or washed up on the harbor, and somebody thought it was somebody else, so then Nancy Guilford thought she was in the clear.
Correct.
It's wild.
Yes, yes. It's a wild ride, and the marriage, too, was so dysfunctional.
Want to get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
So two of the key people in this book are Nancy Guilford, who performed this abortion, two of them went south, and her husband Henry, who was the huckster, got her into the business. There's a really interesting scene to me. Like, tell me if you agree with this. I did not find Henry to be a complex character. He was just an interesting huckster who was interesting to read about, whereas Nancy Guilford I found very complex. She was doing something that needed to be done, which was abortions in this hypocritical world from all levels of society. She had to be cold-hearted to do it, dispose of bodies, chop them up if that happened, had to go on the run and put the pressure on the families. But she also did something for women that needed to be done, right? And and she also had this, women didn't have power in any level of the abortions. They, even though men knew it went on, they could prosecute the crime or wink. And in this, her own marriage, she was kind of, I wondered whether she had the power or when her husband kind of, because here's the scene I was interested in. At one point, this woman's pregnant. I think she was a chambermaid and needed an abortion. And it turns out she needs an abortion from Nancy, that she got pregnant from Nancy's husband, who was having an affair with her in the house where they lived.
Yes, that was.
Nancy Guilford's in this position where she finds out that this young woman, I guess they call her a girl, Jenny Peters, got pregnant from her husband. She needs to do an abortion. And she didn't get mad at her husband, at least according to the book. She got mad at Jenny Peters.
Yeah, well, it was actually Iva Marsh who was caring for Jenny Peters.
Oh, it was Iva Marsh.
Yes, Jenny Peters was, as you say, a domestic. And she had also, she was suffering from an abortion, which she had fought off an infection, but apparently been left with some organ damage or something like that. And Iva Marsh was trained by Nancy to be a nurse, to care round the clock for Jenny, and Iva Marsh became the victim of Henry. And
Sex. Okay, had sex with Ida.
Eva. Okay. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I V like Valentine A. Marsh.
Okay, so sorry I remembered that wrong. So, but when she finds out, she doesn't get mad at Henry in your book.
No, she gets mad.
Would
at
you mind
Iva.
Reading that part along or aloud? It's page 40. This is from Marcia Biederman's The Disquieting Death of Emma Gill.
Meanwhile, with Jenny gone, life on Lewis Street resumed its usual rhythms. The business of the house downstairs was generally walled off from upstairs family life. However, one day, raised voices brought Nancy to a staircase landing. Without the benefit of a telephone, sound was traveling clearly between the floors. To Nancy's amazement, her nurse was arguing loudly with the master of the house. Summoned upstairs for an explanation, Iva Marsh declared that Henry had been forcing sex on her, not just once, but repeatedly. Nancy received this news by unleashing her fury on the victim. It might have come as no real surprise. Jenny Peters had probably said much the same thing. However, it wouldn't be quite so easy to push Iva Marsh out the door. By now, the young nurse knew the signs. She was pregnant.
So in other words, Nancy had to make some quick calculations.
Yes.
So Iva was also pregnant.
Iva was pregnant. Jenny had already had an abortion and had been...
But what Nancy's realizing is that Iva's pregnant.
Yes.
And pregnant from Henry.
Correct.
Now, she's not mad at Henry. Do you think at that point it had already become a marriage of convenience where they're both deep on this abortion business? And also, women didn't have as much independence for making a living in those days, right? Did she have a dependence on Henry for finance?
She might have thought she did at that time. Then I think this was a turning point in the marriage, and it's very astute of you, Paul, to identify that event as something that changed the marriage and changed Nancy's attitude toward her work. I think that was it for the marriage.
It's business.
She did take out her anger on Iva and charged her for an abortion. I mean, that was the crowning
right, from her
insult.
Husband. Yeah, yes. That's what I mean.
Yes, and then she also refused later to give Iva a referral when I was, Nancy fired Iva and then
and
put
when
her,
people yeah. don't have power completely and they're mad about it, who they take it out on is yeah. so interesting to
yes,
me.
Yes, yes. I think it was this burst of irrationality, and I think that...
Was it irrational, though? Because wasn't Nancy, as the abortionist, also quickly always knowing what she needed to do to survive another day? Like, she knew, as you pointed out, that Iva had the goods on her. She knew all the illegal things that were going on because she was part of them. She had information.
Well, she didn't stop Iva from testifying because
Becomes later, and also yeah. Jenny Peters testified.
Yes, yes. It's amazing that those women did go to court. However, who knows what the prosecutors were threatening them with, because it was also illegal for women to have abortions. That was in the cases that I cover in my book, no woman was prosecuted for having had an abortion, but Iva and Jenny both had them, and the prosecutor knew that. So maybe that's what...
Well, they bring Jenny back years later to testify the first of two trials against Nancy.
Yes.
And we're talking to Marcia Biederman about her fascinating new book, The Disquieting Death of Emmett Gill, about abortion in New Haven and Bridgeport at the turn of the 20th century. So, Marcia, you had when your book then pivots to trials, which are really fascinating. And in the first trial of two of the women's abortions, you call it the Salem Trials. That's the chapter heading. Why did you call it that?
Well, because people think the Salem
witches. The witches.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, how specific were you about that metaphor? What were you trying to say? Were you just saying, because it's kind of like the way we did at The Advocate, you'd always do a song title or something and a fun kind of clever name pops up in your head? Or was there something deeper about witch trials and abortion trials?
Well, they were going after Nancy very hard with something that shouldn't have been criminal in the first place. Whatever we think of Nancy, and I agree with you that although Henry is a pure villain and she is not, she's not always sympathetic. I would call her like an anti-hero.
Yeah, real
so,
life.
Yeah, which
a reflection
she has,
of her times and the contradictions of society in our time.
Yes, the society at large was responsible for these events, not just Nancy, but of course. We also have to look at what role people played within society.
But I love this, too. She knew how to also play on society's hypocrisy. She always presented herself as an upper-class woman
yes.
of society. And when she was brought back from England, when she fled on the boat, she charmed the person who was supposed to keep her, watch on her.
The prison matron.
And the prison matron told the press what an upper-class woman she was. She
yes.
surely couldn't have been guilty of anything. She wouldn't do such,
The prison matron became her press agent.
Right. I'm just saying it because I think Nancy was clever in knowing that society doesn't really want to confront its contradictions about we secretly, not so secretly, allowing abortion. We're saying it's bad. Someone's got to do it. Does that make the person who does it a dirty person? Or could it be a person, if they present themselves as a successful person, which she was, and a smart and capable person, which she was, who wore nice clothes, could that then make her look innocent in the eyes of the prison matron and the public, which is, I think, the PR game Nancy was playing?
Yeah, she became relatable. I mean, that nowadays there are people who coach defendants in criminal trials to how to dress, how to present themselves. Nancy didn't need that. She instinctively knew how to do that. And she was a farmer's daughter from Wellsburg, New York, which is a suburb of Elmira. So these are not cosmopolitan metropolises. The only other job she had was teaching in her own village elementary school, the one she had attended as a child. And when she got married, she would have had to give up teaching in those days. So how could she become someone that people thought of as looking like a successful woman lecturer only through practicing abortion?
When you think about today, too, about whether it's the drug trade or when prohibition doesn't work, people who make a lot of money in what society is allowing to be with the highest levels of official corruption, hypocrisy, important generators of income in our economy, and how people get seen as respectable, what it takes, whether you're rise in the drug trade or whether it's political corruption, you do a kind of lot of skanky stuff. But then once you've made a lot of money, you start presenting yourself as a respectable person in society, and you're in a social class often with the other people whose ways of getting money, even though you and I might call them theft, are often not legitimate.
Right.
So society's calling them legitimate, right?
Right, right.
I wouldn't call hedge funds legitimate. Yeah. I wouldn't call venture capital legitimate. It's just exploitation and produces nothing good for society. But they all end up at the same balls, and it kind of complicates how we see them.
Right. It's like the three penny opera. The criminals decide to just become bankers.
Yeah. So when we look at when you look at how abortion was legal and illegal at the same time, it wasn't legal, technically legal, but it was allowed to go on in a big way. But women had to put their lives more at risk than they should have had, and the people conducting it always were trying to stay one step of law. How do you look now at what's happening in America?
Oh, yeah.
Post-Dobbs, post-Roe, what does this tell us? When you look, what is the same and what's different, and what can we learn from your story?
Well, I lived pre-Roe also, because I'm of that age group that was in college before Roe, and it was even worse. So, because now, and I'm talking about before even New York and California legalized it, that the pre-Roe era, also legal in New York and California. Girls used to go, well, the female students, they're young women.
We always talk about it in the office. When are college students girls and what are they women? That seems to change with each iteration of feminism.
Right. But I'll just call them, my classmates would go up, and if they had an unwanted pregnancy in which they really wanted to terminate, they would go up and down the hallway collecting money for a very expensive and unsafe illegal abortion. You know, someone would know someone who knew someone who was doing, you know, backstreet abortions. We thought of them as probably in filthy offices. I did have a classmate who said she woke up from the sedation or anesthesia, and the male abortion provider was kissing her all over her body. We were there until Roe, and then we're back to it, except that some states are codifying the right. So it's a slightly better landscape for those who
for half the country.
Yeah.
What do you say about the half of the country now where abortions become illegal?
What do I say?
Well, how does your book story and the landscape you saw in America then compare to the landscape that's developing in red America?
Well, we're going to hear some of these penny dreadful stories about. We haven't heard them about corpses being chopped up, probably. I wouldn't be surprised. They haven't emerged yet. But then again, as you and I just discussed, there probably were deaths along the way in the offices of Nancy and Henry, but the family cooperated in concealing that. But I'm sorry to say, we're probably going to get that. It's there's a lot of dangerous stuff going on, and it's only a matter of time. Some women can, you know, depending where is the nearest state where abortion is still legal, can get away from those bans at the moment. But other people cannot afford to do it. And this was even becoming true under Roe, because there were many counties in the United States where there was no abortion clinic within, you know, a day's travel, because the atmosphere.
But now they're outlawing going to other states. I mean, that's what's so strange now. They're outlawing going to another state.
Well, that's being hung up in court right now. You're talking about Idaho. Yes, yeah. That's crazy.
So what I thought went brilliant, I think you're a terrific writer, Marcia. I always have. And one thing that's so interesting to me is I feel like these ideas were throughout your book, but they weren't stated overtly. You were just telling the story so well. And the only, I could be wrong about this because I was wrong about Jenny and I, but well, the only place I saw you even touching on saying, hey, folks, there's a story here that's not just in the past, is the very last line of the book, which I thought is a great last line of the book. So we've just spent hundreds of pages in the world of Victorian New England. And your last line was, in the year of Nancy Guilford's death, Margaret Sanger came to the Vassar Alumni House in Poughkeepsie to talk about birth control.
Right, and Nancy had been living in Poughkeepsie. Yes.
So what was your point?
That we're going into another era, and the big issue is going to become contraception, and that is where the church organized its efforts for a while. Margaret Sanger went to jail. She's another mixed character as people look back on her history.
Eugenics, yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be another chapter, and it's going to be another resource that's available to American women and men that is very important in reproductive rights.
And when you look at the case in New Haven that led to contraception becoming legal, is it going to be the same path where we're going to deal first with contraception to get back at the abortion issue? Is that step one to step two? Because it kind of was the case in
then you're talking about Griswold. Yeah,
yeah.
Connecticut really has left a mark. By the way, New Haven was called a hotbed of abortion. You know that, Paul, because you actually, you can mix up Jenny and Iva all you want. It's probably my writing. You've done a very careful reading in this book, which is more than most journalists ever
do. So what's been the reaction to the book?
I'm very disappointed by one thing. Publishers Weekly declined to review it. You know, my publisher just automatically sends new books.
Why'd they decline?
They don't give reasons for why they decline it, but I think it's terrible. This is not my first book. It's my fourth nonfiction book. So PW knows that I'm a competent writer because they've given me some positive reviews in the past. I wasn't asking for a star or a rave, but I was asking for a review.
Have you gotten any other reactions, any other reads?
Well, the American Library Association has a journal that is recommended books only, and they did review it, and I'm very grateful to them, Booklist. So that helped put it in a lot of libraries. I'm so happy.
How about other people? People you dealt with in the book have looked at it?
I have my blurbers, of course, you know, people who I really don't know them, a lot of them personally, and a coroner said that I would have made a very good coroner.
Your details are great. I've never gotten a
better compliment in my life.
So you have, I noticed you have not just New Haven, you had another Connecticut event coming up.
Yes, I do have one in Milldale, which is part of Southington, and that's going to be on April 3rd. And I'm very excited about that because Emma Gill, it's true, I don't have her letters because they were burned by her sexual partner, well, at his request, obviously. Her letters to him were burned, but Emma Gill was from Southington, and she was finally correctly identified as that woman whose remains were found in the Bridgeport waters. And so we're going to have an event there and talk about all the Southington people, everyone who was prominent in Southington, whose name is still recognized, their descendants live there, or their names are on buildings, is involved in that story.
And the man who got him pregnant was from the family that owned the main store.
The variety store, which later grew into a department store, so that it's like everybody.
Oh, so it's part of their history.
Everybody in Southington. Well,
that's going to be an interesting event.
Yes, and the defense lawyer became a governor of Connecticut at a very advanced age, but he took Connecticut through World War One and was reelected. But he was one of the defense lawyers in that case. And they're all buried near each other. Emma Gill is buried near Harry Oxley, the young man who was involved in her pregnancy and shopped for the abortion provider with her. They're all buried within a few hundred feet of each other.
But not next to each other.
Well, their wives are, you know, buried next to them.
Okay. Hotbed of abortion.
Emma Gill never had the chance to become anybody's wife.
Although there was a guy who thought she was going to be.
Yes, I think that was her plan. There was another young woman.
She had
woman
her love, and then she had the useful person, the person who was marriage material.
Yeah, she had plans for her life, and I think that's fine. And she was, even though she died in 1898, she wore a waist, which is a blouse, and a skirt instead of a gown. She rode a bicycle. She had a job. I think she was like a new woman. I wish I knew more about her.
Well, you found a lot about a lot of people in this book, and that's what made it so fascinating. Is there going to be a movie?
Oh, I'd love that. And I think it would make a great one.
Amazing movie. You already wrote it like the movie. You have the body, you know, the kids discovering the bag with the body. Come on.
From your lips to Hollywood's ears.
Or it could be a six-part Netflix.
I agree with you, 100%, Paul.
Well, if you know anybody who's good at writing scripts, let them know about it.
Oh, well, I think I know somebody, and you know who I'm referring to.
Get the book, The Disquieting Death of Emma Gill, Chicago Review Press, and at the New Haven Public Library, the main branch, the Eyes Branch on Elm Street, Wednesday, March 20th, 6 p.m. Marcia's going to be there in person telling this amazing story, and it's free. So we want you to go. Marcia, thanks so much for making the time. It's so great to reconnect with you after these years. It was so much fun to see that your writing is still an A game, still on your A game.
Oh, thank you so much, Paul. It was wonderful to be here.
And thanks to Harry Droz, as always, for working the controls and getting us in all the levels of the multiverse of podcasting. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day, all night, and all week long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.